God's wisdom from three perspectives. And so today, we're going to examine the question, what were the three books of wisdom? Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Job trying to teach? And how did they go about teaching it? To begin, the wisdom literature is different from the other Old Testament books in that it addresses the individual and not the nation. These books don't have a lot to say about institutional religion or the nation as a covenant people. They primarily focus on daily, successful, moral living. And because they had an approach that was independent from the traditional or orthodox religious teaching of the day, they were able to raise tough philosophical and theological questions and to discuss them without the stricter restraints that the law and the prophets were held to. The wise men not only tried to teach how one can live a good life by living by the guidelines of godly wisdom in all kinds of situations, they also tried to come up with a rational explanation for the age-old question, why do bad things happen to good people? Each of these three books has its own unique perspective on how to live well in this life, even when things aren't going your way or when things aren't going the way that you had expected. As we explore the teachings of Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Job, we have to keep in mind that these books were written not only for spiritual Israel, but for natural Israel as well. So, when looking for the lessons in these books, we have to ask ourselves, is this for natural Israel? Is this for spiritual Israel? Or can it be applied to both? The promises to natural Israel are not the same as those to spiritual. And quite often, they are completely opposite of each other. Natural Israel was promised in Deuteronomy 28:11. If you keep the commandments, God will make thee plenteous in goods, in the fruit of thy body, and in the fruit of thy cattle, and in the fruit of thy ground, in the land which the Lord sware unto thy fathers to give thee. The nature of these blessings reminds us of the blessing in the Garden of Eden, when God said, enjoy the land I have given you, and be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. They were earthly promises. Now we of spiritual Israel, on the other hand, are asked to sacrifice these earthly blessings in order to receive a spiritual reward. So for 3,000 years, these books of wisdom spoke exclusively and literally to natural, fleshly Israel. They are a wise teacher, imparting lessons about life, giving advice when things were going well and when things were not going well. And in the person of Job, these lessons were lived and experience to the full. All three books of wisdom, though different from each other, together give a balanced view of human experience and living a life that is pleasing to God. So as we go through each book, I'm going to give a general lesson, but I am not going to suggest whether it be applied to natural Israel or to spiritual Israel. That is for each of us in our own unique circumstances to do for ourselves. The first book of the three books of wisdom we'll consider today is the book of Proverbs. It has a perspective on life that is, for the most part, pretty black and white. It says, if you do the right thing in all of life's situations, you will be rewarded. And if you don't, well, you will suffer the consequences of your bad choices. Proverbs says there is a direct cause and effect relationship to everything in our lives. It's almost like a law of the universe. It's just how things work. Proverbs says there is an actual invisible force in the world that can guide people in how they should live. This invisible force is kind of like gravity. You can't see it, but it affects everything that we do. So, what is this mysterious invisible force that is so critical to the book of Proverbs? It is wisdom. In Hebrew, it is called chokmah. It is, Proverbs says, an attribute of God. It's specifically an attribute of God that he used to create the universe. For instance, Proverbs 3:19 says, "The Lord by wisdom hath founded the earth." Psalm 104:24 says, "O Lord, how manifold are thy works! In wisdom thou hast made them all. All earth is full of thy riches." Now the concept that God's attribute of chokmah, or wisdom, was used to create the universe seems to be well established and ingrained in the book of Proverbs. But where might that idea have come from? Surely there has to be some logical basis for it. It just wasn't made up out of thin air. Well, it may have come from the second verse of the Bible. Genesis 1, verses 1 and 2 reads, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters." The condition of the earth as being formless and void refers to the earth as a place not yet ready for humans to live on. God's Spirit hovering over the waters describes the work of God in the initial stages of creation, of making the earth good, a place for human habitation. God did his work of creation by means of the Spirit of God. In Proverbs, I believe, they are saying God's wisdom, or chokmah, is equivalent to the Spirit of God as it pertains to his work of creation. This creative attribute of God, chokmah, or wisdom, Proverbs teaches, is therefore woven into the very fabric of the world and how things work in the world. And this invisible force is available to every Israelite just for the asking. It's something like how we view the work of the Spirit of God in our lives. So, according to Proverbs, whenever people make good and wise and just decisions in life, they are being guided by chokmah. And anyone who makes a bad decision is actually working against chokmah by refusing to be guided by God's creative attribute of wisdom. So, Chokmah in Proverbs is viewed as a moral law of the universe, just like gravity is a natural law. No one can escape the cause and effect relationship of either law. And this concept of Chokmah is key to the understanding of Proverbs. And how does Proverbs portray this concept of an invisible force? It personifies it as a woman. It calls her wisdom. For instance, Proverbs 3, verses 13 through 18 reads, "Happy is the man that findeth wisdom, and the man that getteth understanding. For the merchandise of it is better than the merchandise of silver, and the gain thereof than fine gold. She is more precious than rubies, and all the things that thou canst desire are not to be compared unto her. Length of days is in her right hand, and in her left hand riches and honor. Her ways are ways of pleasantness, and all her paths are peace. She is a tree of life to them that lay hold upon her. Happy is every one that retaineth her. The Lord by wisdom hath founded the earth. By understanding he hath established the heavens." The picture drawn here is that Lady Wisdom roams about the earth, calling out and making herself available to anyone willing to listen and to learn from her. And if you will but access and use this wisdom, you will create a good life for yourself. Well, how do you go about doing this? Because wisdom is an attribute of God, you have to start with a healthy respect for God's definition of good and evil. And the only path to true wisdom is learning those boundary lines and not crossing them. And how do you do this? Through the study of God's Word, and especially the study of the wisdom literature, and through experience. And so we find hundreds of proverbs and sayings in the book of Proverbs about any and all aspects of life. And if wisdom is applied to these situations and its wise counsel is followed, it will put you on a path to success in life. Ignore wisdom, and you will suffer the consequences. So, that is the wisdom of the book of Proverbs. Seek out and use wisdom, this invisible creative force in the universe, and your life will be good. And I think that in general, we can all agree with this conclusion. Make wise decisions based on godly principles, and things will much more often than not work out for you. The book of Proverbs is really beautiful. But if we were to take a step back, we might say it's a little too simplistic because life doesn't always work the way it's supposed to work according to the book of Proverbs. Good and wise people do suffer, and foolish people are sometimes rewarded. So how does wisdom explain this? This is where the next book of wisdom, Ecclesiastes, or the words of the preacher, come in. While Proverbs taught, if you use God's wisdom, You will create a happy and successful life for yourself. The preacher says, well, hold on there, Mr. Optimist. If you think using wisdom will bring you guaranteed success in life, well, you had just better think again, because life here under the sun is vanity. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Now that's a phrase the preacher uses a lot, about 40 times in the book of Ecclesiastes. So, what does it mean? The English word vanity comes from the Hebrew word habel. It's Strong's number 1892, and it's defined there as emptiness, or transitory, or unsatisfactory. Jacinius' Hebrew lexicon of the Old Testament describes it in a number of ways, including a vapor, a mist, or a darkness that cannot be seen through. So we seem to have here two choices of what habel or vanity could mean. The preacher could be saying life here under the sun is empty and transitory and unsatisfactory, or he could be saying life is somehow like a vapor or a mist or darkness, a kind of mist or fog that you can't see through. Now, I don't think the preacher thinks that life is empty. If he did, he wouldn't waste his time trying to understand life and writing a book about his observations. I think the preacher is saying that the meaning of life and the reasons that things are the way they are, where you can't explain or understand things, is because life is sometimes like being in a fog. You just can't see clearly while you're in the midst of it. The preacher's brand of wisdom is a counterbalance to Proverbs, where everything is perfectly understandable because life is determined by a cosmic principle that ensures that you always get what you deserve. The preacher says you don't always get what you deserve, and you'll drive yourself crazy if you think you can control life's outcomes so that they always come out the way that you think they should. Sometimes life here under the sun is going to be like habel or vanity. It's going to be rather foggy as to why things work out the way they do. You just have to come to grips with the fact that you can't always see clearly when it comes to this life. So, as the preacher seems to be saying, if everything in life is not predicated on the invisible creative force, as it says in Proverbs, if there is no inescapable cause and effect relationship, no law of the universe that explains why people are rewarded and punished, why some are successful and others are not, why good things happen to bad people and bad things happen to good people, then how do you explain all this? Well, he says, you can't. He says there is a mystery that surrounds men's lives. Its meaning is often hard, if not impossible to fathom, because God has kept its meaning hidden from him. So if God has kept hidden the mystery of life, of why things happen the way they do, how does the preacher explain it? The preacher says it's unknowable using human wisdom. The preacher explains it this way in Ecclesiastes 8:16 and 17. When I applied mine heart to know wisdom and to see the business that is done upon the earth, for also there is that neither day nor night seeth sleep with his eyes, then I beheld all the work of God, that a man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. Because though a man labor to seek it out, yet he shall not find it. Yea, further, though a wise man think he know it, yet shall he not be able to find it. In other words, to even the best of human reasoning, the random and unpredictable and unexplainable nature of life is often explainable only by chance. The preacher says in Ecclesiastes 9, 11, and 12, I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, neither yet bread to the wise, nor yet riches to men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill, but time and chance happeneth to them all. For man knoweth not his time, as the fishes that are taken in an evil net, and as the birds that are caught in the snare, so are the sons of men snared in an evil time, when it falleth suddenly upon them. In other words, there is no guarantee that doing the right thing will always lead to success in this life. Life is way too unpredictable. You can't control what you can't predict. If you think you can master and control all of life's outcomes, if you think that by doing everything right and by the book, you will sail through life on flowery beds of ease, then you are just setting yourself up for a fall. As he points out in 9:12, the birds and the fish were just doing normal bird and fish things when they got caught up in the net, when they ran into serious trouble. It's the same with us. You can be doing everything right, but still be caught up in a net of trouble. Why it happens is often a mystery. Life is vanity. It is hebel. Its meaning is often misty. It is confusing and disorienting, and it is oftentimes uncontrollable. Well, what are we supposed to do with the preacher's rather negative observations? Should we get depressed, or should we become cynical? That's not what the preacher recommends. His conclusion to the matter is found in 12:13, and it says, "Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man." At first glance, this is a bit surprising coming from such an apparent cynic. But when you think of it, it does make perfect sense. He's saying that just because the results aren't guaranteed, just because there may not be a good result waiting for you as a result of your good decisions in life, is that any reason not to make good decisions? No. We are to do the right thing because it is the right thing to do. Because we wholeheartedly believe that it is the right thing to do. So the preacher says, do the right thing. Live according to godly principle and don't worry about the results. Leave that to God. And how do you go about doing this in a practical way where so much of life is unpredictable, unknowable, and out of your control. Well, the preacher tells us in Ecclesiastes 9, 7 to 10, go thy way, eat thy bread with joy, and drink thy wine with a merry heart, for God now accepteth thy works. Let thy garments be always white, and let thy head lack no ointment. Live joyfully with the wife whom thou lovest all the days of the life of thy vanity, which he hath given thee under the sun, all the days of thy vanity, for that is thy portion in this life, and in thy labor which thou takest under the sun. Whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with thy might, for there is no work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in the grave whither thou goest. So what's the preacher's message here? Is it eat, drink, and be merry? Just party your way through life? Do whatever makes you happy at the moment, regardless of whether it's the right or wrong thing to do, whether it's moral or immoral, pleasing to God or not? Is that the preacher's wise counsel here? No. Not by a long shot. What he is advising is this. He says, since you cannot see life so clearly as to be able to control every aspect of your life, you should just stop trying to control those things you have no control over. Just stop fretting over those things. He says, loosen your grip. Learn to hold those things in your life you have no control over in an open hand. Because in this life, you have 100% control over only one thing. And that is your attitude towards the present moment. So choose to enjoy the sun on your face, or a good meal, a conversation with people that you care about. Choose to enjoy every moment of the love and companionship of your wife and your husband. Choose to appreciate and enjoy all these good gifts of God. But remember that you also control your attitude towards the moments when bad things come your way. Good and bad happen to us all. They too are a part of this life, and they too are a gift from God. And that's the surprising wisdom from the book of Ecclesiastes. Even though life can lead you into some dark places where it's hard to see the meaning, don't lose hope. Trust that God will one day clear away the fog and reveal his hidden meaning and purpose in life. And all through this life's journey, fear the Lord and keep his commandments. Always try to do what is right and just and pleasing to the Lord. And don't worry about the outcome. That is not always yours to control. And choose to enjoy the life that God has granted you, because it is God's gift to you and it is beautiful. And that's the book of Ecclesiastes. Now there's one more voice that makes up the biblical wisdom literature, and that is the book of Job. He will bring us the final perspective on our journey into wisdom. Job begins with a story about a meeting in the heavens. God is there with a number of angelic beings called the sons of God, who have been summoned to present themselves before God. It's kind of like an executive board meeting of heavenly beings, kind of a heavenly command center, if you will. And God opens the meeting by asking one of these sons of God, "Whence comest thou?" Or, in other words, "What have you been up to?" Then one of these sons of God approaches. He's referred to in the Hebrew as the Satan. This word is actually a title which literally means the one who is opposed. The Satan was a kind of spy roaming the earth and reporting to God on all the evil that he had found. And the Satan has a rather dim view of mankind, and he's convinced that every man has his price or his breaking point. In other words, he's looking for trouble, and he thinks if he looks hard enough, he will find it. And God, knowing the Satan's view of humanity, kind of taunts him by asking him if he's giving any thought to Job. He's the one man that will prove you wrong. There is none like him in all the earth. There is no price that could sway him to become unrighteous. He is perfect and upright. So the Satan, who is confident in his assessment of men, rises to the bait, and he counters by proposing that Job probably really doesn't love God. And the only reason he is a good person is because God rewards him for it. So, if God were to take away all the things that he gave to Job, well, then we would see Job's true colors. He further suggests Job is only obeying God because it's getting him what he wants. He's just working the system. If you take away all these great things you've given Job, he'll curse you to your face. And so God agrees to this experiment to test Job. And he allows the Satan to inflict suffering on Job. And Job loses everyone and everything that he cares about in this world. And he is understandably just devastated. And remember, he deserves none of this. God himself said so. And Job proves what a remarkable person he is because he still praises God, at least in the first two chapters. But then in chapter 3, he spills his guts and he vents about how truly rotten he really feels inside. There he unleashes this long, elaborate curse about the day that he was born, lamenting that it would have been better that he died in birth rather than to live and come to this devastating end. And after this, some of Job's friends come to offer their help. They all say to Job that surely you must have done something really bad to deserve all this. "Be reasonable," they say. "We all know the world is ordered by God's justice and fairness. So there's really no other explanation than you're getting what you deserve." And so it goes for the next 34 chapters as the friends and Job argue back and forth. The friends keep speculating about why God sent such suffering, and they even start making up lists of hypothetical sins that Job must have committed. But after each accusation, Job defends his innocence, and he is innocent. He's also on an emotional roller coaster. One minute, he's very confident in God's wisdom and justice. The next, he's starting to doubt God's goodness. He even goes so far as to accuse God of being reckless and unfair. And by the end of this dialogue between Job and his friends, Job has had enough of speculating about why God has permitted such suffering. He demands that God come and explain himself in person. And God does. He comes in the form of a great storm cloud. But God doesn't give Job the direct answer he's looking for about why he's suffering. God never tells Job about the conversation with the Satan or the testing of his character and loyalty to God. Instead, he does something really different. He takes Job on a virtual tour of the universe. He shows Job just how incredibly awesome the world is. He shows Job how much detail is in the world, things we see every day, but have no idea how they work. But God knows. He knows it all. He pays attention to the operations of this beautiful and intricate universe in ways we haven't ever imagined or in places that we will never see. And then he asked Job, "Do you understand all this? Do you understand any of this? Do you think you could run all this, even for a day?" Then, to conclude his virtual tour of the universe, God shows Job two wondrous beasts, the behemoth and the leviathan. And he tells Job how great they are. "These are dangerous beasts who would kill you at the drop of a hat." God says, in effect, these are not evil beasts. They are also a part of his good creation. And then, that's it. That's God's whole defense for why Job was allowed to suffer even though he didn't do anything to deserve it. So what was this all about? What is the book of Job teaching us about wisdom? It seems to be this. From Job's point of view, it looks as though God is not fair. He's not just, and he's not loving, because he allows the innocent to suffer when he has the power to stop it. And in this, Job speaks for all humanity at some point in their lives. But God's perspective is infinitely bigger than Job's. He is concerned with and interacting with the whole universe of complexity when he makes his decisions, including the good of mankind. And this is what God calls his wisdom. And so Job, or humanity, asking God to defend himself is really kind of absurd, because mankind, without the Holy Spirit, cannot understand this kind of complexity about why they suffer, even if they wanted to. So where does this leave us? Where does it leave Job? It leaves Job in a place of humility. He never learned why he suffered, and yet he is still able to carry on and live his life in peace and in the fear of the Lord. But that's not where the book ends, because after all of this, God restores to Job double everything that he'd lost. Now, this naturally raises the question, is this a reward? Is God saying, "Congratulations, Job, you passed this big test, and now here's your reward"? No, not at all. The whole book just made the point that Job losing everything was not a punishment. So now getting it back is not a reward. So why does he get it back? Apparently, God, in his wisdom, decided to give Job a gift. We're not told why. But what we do know is that Job is now the kind of person that no matter what comes, the good or the bad, he can trust God's wisdom. And that's the lesson and the wisdom of the book of Job. Humble yourself in the sight of God and trust him, even where you cannot trace him. And that's the wisdom literature. Each one offers a unique perspective on life. And we have to hear all of them together as we learn to live with wisdom and in the fear of the Lord. And so the books of wisdom spoke to natural Israel, guiding them in a life that was pleasing to God. To them, the promises of following God's wisdom were literal. To us, they are mostly spiritual, but sometimes they can be literal or applicable. When all three books are taken together, they give us a balanced approach to living a godly life in accordance to his wisdom.